I have Peter Steinhauer here. He's an American photographer who spent a lot of time in Vietnam, and I'm here in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for bringing me into your life in the last week, really.
Wow, we're super happy to have you in here with us, and yeah, thanks for having me on here today. It's great to be on this.
So I'm here because of Vietnam Society, Vietnam Week, that you and Erin, your wife, created. I knew that there was a lot of stories that you as a photographer would come to the table with one day in the podcast. But we were at dinner last night and we started talking about your work specifically with the churches.
Yeah.
But before we get into that, I'd like to ask you, what was the journey that led you to Vietnam?
Yeah, okay, that actually started when I was literally born, because my father was in the war, 1966, 67. He was a lieutenant commander in the 3rd Marine Division. He was an oral surgeon, and he was in Da Nang. And I was born 2 weeks after he left. So when he came back, he had all these slides that he had, of course, later on when I realized, you know, when I was old enough to know, you know, he had to take slides for records of everyone that he worked on. He was only on the MASH unit, you know, on the 3rd Marine Division, their base. It's right there. Actually, it's still right next to the, it's a Vietnamese military base now. It's just right off the airport runway. When you land going north, there's some hills off to the side, about a kilometer off, and that's the base. It's now a Vietnamese military base, but that's where he was. And so he took a lot of slides and snapshots when he would go out to the surrounding villages and kind of clean teeth on the weekends of women, children of women who were the military base hired, and they onto the base, and they'd do the laundry and cleaning the barracks and so on. And he and some other doctors, they were giving back to them, and he would go out and so during those times, he was taking snapshots of, you know, rice fields and houses and, you know, the villages and black teeth. You know, my dad was totally, you know, fascinated with these black teeth.
So this must have been in Hanoi.
No, this was in Da Nang.
In Da Nang.
Yeah, in Da Nang.
I missed that. So yeah. Da Nang had black teeth.
Yes,
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, so can we get into that?
Like, yeah.
What do you know about the black teeth from your father or from just being there?
Well, I first originally learned it from my father that they were black teeth. I had no idea why. And then later on, when I moved to Hanoi in 1993, I learned about the background of the black teeth. I can't say I'm an historical expert on it.
Did you ask your dad about the black teeth when you got back, or when you got there?
He didn't know the history of it. Yeah, he didn't know.
Did he know any of the technical side, like why or if it really in fact saved their teeth or made it better quality of life?
Nope. He didn't know anything about that. And originally, this is what I've heard consistently. I've heard a few different versions, but consistently, during Japanese invasion, the French invasions, that it was done because of raping and making their teeth black, particularly the French. This is just what I've heard.
Yeah.
Just, it was a, for lack of a better term, it was a complete turnoff, you know, seeing women with black teeth.
Interesting.
And that's what I've heard. Now, anyone else out there who's listening to this, there could be much different versions, but I've heard actually 3 or 4 different reasons why. Japanese invasions and to separate them, actually knowing that who was Chinese, who was Vietnamese, you know, to separate themselves during, you know, different nationalities during different wars. So that's what I've heard. And so to differentiate themselves. So because of rapes, because of showing, you know, who was Vietnamese, who wasn't Vietnamese and so on, that's what I've always heard.
And did the men have black teeth too?
For the most part, no. But I've seen a tremendous amount of men
with black teeth.
Only in the north.
Right.
And far in the north. Never in Hanoi. There's a very famous artist in Hanoi who has them. And he did that I think in the late 90s, he dyed his teeth black. I got to say, as an artist and seeing so many, it's stunning.
It looks cool.
It's really, really beautiful when they are done well. There's a one particular ethnic minority that I photographed when I was doing my project during the late 90s and early 2000s. And I was solidly working on ethnic minorities at that time. And she was a Noom minority in Hazang province. And her teeth were lacquer black. And her teeth were just perfectly kept. No receding gum lines or any, and they were so beautiful. And she had jet black eyes and black hair, and they all wear black. And it was like an incredible.
Did you take a picture of her?
Yes, okay. I do. I have and I'll show it to you.
Yeah, maybe we can insert this in somehow. Yeah,
she's so intense looking, and she was so sweet. But her look is just really, really intense.
Let's go back to why you came to Vietnam.
Yeah. So, back to that reason. Anyway, fast forward. Well, all through from third grade until I was a senior in high school, I gave slideshows for extra credit of my father's snapshots when he went out to these villages and just doing all of this stuff, and then. They were images of him, of course, of the MASH unit and the base, the Marine base. And third grade until I was a senior in high school, I gave, an hour-long slideshow and a presentation. So by the time I got to 12th grade, I knew the history of the war. I knew quite a bit about the war. And even growing up, even in 7th grade, I remember one of my teachers. I'm from Boulder, Colorado. So lots of hippies there, anti-war people. One of my teachers was a big-time hippie, and I think he was. My father was in the classroom with him, and I think he was just really blown away that this kid, seventh grader, was giving a slideshow for an hour on the Vietnam War. So my father, in 1989, went back to Vietnam for the first time. He wanted to see who this war was against, and
how did he get to go back in 89? There's nothing opened up.
Oh yeah, for tourism it was open
in 89.
Oh yeah, it was open in the 80s.
Really?
Yeah, but to Americans, I don't know exactly what date it was, but there were Americans who were. I know of a photographer who was living there. He was in shooting in 1985.
I did not know that.
Yeah,
I didn't. But I don't think the American government let Americans go back legally.
Well, even when I moved there, in 93, it was 2.5 years before we had diplomatic relations. It was still the embargo.
And you had a direct flight in?
No, I flew to the U.S. and then fly into, you had to fly into Bangkok. Whether it was, I don't even know the legalities if we were able to buy things and bring them out. I have no idea. I didn't care. I didn't care.
Why? Why didn't you care? What?
Because I always thought, I remember thinking when I was a little kid, I thought of this whole thing, this thing against Cuba. Like, why? Yeah. Who says I can't go to Cuba? Why? Who, the government puts these rules in that I can't go to Cuba just because they had a conflict? Why can't another human go to Cuba?
Did your dad sort of guide you along that way of thinking? Did he kind of set the precedence?
I was blessed when I was a kid. We, as a family, we traveled a lot. My parents took us traveling all the time. And internationally, we traveled internationally. And so I had this...
Yeah, this bold way of looking at going to a place that the American government said, there's restrictions on going there. And for you, I can hear the language. You're like, fuck it. I really don't care.
Yeah, I didn't really care. Although at that time it was legal. And the reason was that there was a certain time where they allowed American servicemen to come back. And I believe that was 87, 88. Mm. Then, so if you were American military, I believe you could start coming back 87. I may be wrong but I know that there was a date on that. But, my father wanted to come back, and he wanted to see who this war was against. So he went back, and he actually went to Hanoi because he wanted to go to the north to see this. And so went in. He went by himself. He was scared to death. He was actually really scared that he was, you know, he might get attacked or hurt. He wasn't worried about getting detained, but he was worried about like people hurting him, someone attacking him or something, because he didn't know. Yeah. I mean, that was you know, enemy territory then, you know. And so, but he always fell in love with, like during the war, he just fell in love with the people and these women who are cleaning the barracks. He was always joking around with them. And when he went out to the villages, he was like, you know, and as a doctor too, he's like working on North Vietnamese prisoners and South Vietnamese. I remember him telling me, and he was like, I don't see the difference. They both look the same. They sound the same to me, even though there was a distinct accent difference for the most part. You know, he had this desire to go back. And so he helped found, after he came back and he found some other doctors who were vets in Colorado, and they formed a group called Friendship Bridge, and they got donated medical equipment from the U.S., from hospitals around the U.S. that the hospitals were getting rid of, and then they brought it to Vietnam and dispersed it all throughout the country to hospitals there. And then they would bring doctors over from there, bring them into Colorado, and they would live in our families. I had these Vietnamese doctors living in our families with us in our houses for a couple of weeks. They would observe surgery, and then they would and this donated equipment, and then they would go back to Vietnam and then teach the doctors back there how to use it. And that at first, of course, started in Hanoi, and then it just went out to the rest of the country that they started working with hospitals there. So in short, my story started when, after a few years, that was 89-90 it started, and I finished art school at the Art Institute of Colorado in 90, you know, I think early 93, 92, I can't remember, and then I had my first chance to go over to Vietnam to live, which is 1993, and I moved. I was going to stay for two months, just make some black and white portraits and some landscapes. And I landed, and it's interesting how I still have it written in my journal. It was like after my 10th day, I was like, I feel like I've found where I'm supposed to be, and I want to live here. And I lived. So I stayed there. I lived in Hanoi for 4.5 years.
There's a lot of subject matter as a photographer that comes from another place. When you're looking out to the landscape, there's so much subject. Yeah. How do you know where to put your crosshairs on?
Well, I mean, I was young then, but I had this very distinct idea of what I was going to do when I got there. My schooling was commercial background schooling. You know, I had always wanted to work for Time Magazine. I wanted to shoot covers of people for Time Magazine. That's what I wanted to do commercially. But my heart and as an artist, I wanted to print for galleries. I wanted to have exhibitions of my work in galleries and print landscapes. And as I shot portraits throughout school and became more involved with portraiture and really focused on portraiture, in particular environmental portraiture, when I landed there, I just saw these, you know, my idea, any photography that was coming out during then in the early 90s, it was all kind of National Geographic looking work, you know, it was color, it was water buffaloes and rice fields, and it was street scenes, great work. But I always wanted to see in people's houses. Like I wanted to see in like factories and workshops, and I wanted to see in artist studios, and I never saw any of that. And everything I saw was color, and it was just like available light. And I'm into lighting. So I like going into environments and setting lights up. So I brought these Swiss lights, these flash units that are about this big, and I can put a light anywhere. And that's my first book, was called Vietnam Portraits and Landscapes. And that's what I did. They were all environmental portraits of Vietnamese who had no interaction really with Westerners and who are just Vietnamese. And they were artists, factory workers, they were countryside people, farmers, pagoda keepers, you name it, just normal people in houses. And so that was my focus when I landed there. But to answer your question, I saw projects everywhere. Like, I was like, look at these roofs and this architecture.
When you are a young photographer and you're looking and there's so many options, do you think about the monetizing side of it? And I ask because I think so many artists that are starting out have this sort of like fear that how can I feed myself? How can I go on with life if I have so much diversity to shoot or to, like, even music? Like, if you're trying to figure out what genre you fit in, you're trying to figure out all this stuff. I mean, how does your brain process the process of eventually making money off of what you're seeing?
Well, I think at least for my case, for the short term or immediate future, you know, 1 to 1.5 years down the road, you know, I'd spoken this over with my parents and I was like, I want to live here. And I want to make work that no one has made. So I was able to, you know, I had saved up money, what I had left from school, which wasn't much, but I had saved stuff and I sold whatever I could to make money. And then my parents also helped fund me, and I gave myself my own master's program. And that's where I came up with this project, Portraits and Landscapes. But I was also fortunate enough that, you know, during this organization that my father helped create, they brought a girl from Hanoi. They, I'll explain just about this. So when any foreigner at that time went in, they had someone from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, a minder with them for any foreigner who wants to work in Vietnam. So my father was teamed up with this certain man and they just hit it off. And eventually felt like they were brothers.
Wow.
And they had this incredible relationship. Foreigners weren't allowed in Vietnamese houses then. So they would meet outside in a restaurant. And they brought their daughter, their oldest daughter, who was then 16. And my parents just like fell in love with her. And so after 4 or 5 times over the next 1.5 years, next 2 years, they... 90 to 92, they asked the family, let's bring her over to Colorado and we'll put her, my parents said she can live with us. We'll put her through her last 6 months of high school. And my dad said, I'll put her through the University of Colorado. And that's what he wanted, that's his reconciliation process. He wanted to give back to this horrible war, you know, that was his first step into like, I want to be reconciled with this so-called enemy. So she came over and lived with my family and I lived with hers. I went over and lived with hers. Her father actually came over and he started working in the Vietnamese mission, which was in New York. And then he was one of 2 or 3 guys that ended up opening the Vietnamese embassy here in DC. And I lived with her family in Hanoi. While he was here, I lived with her mother, her younger sister, and her younger brother, like right in the middle of Hanoi. Like, and only the 10-year-old girl then, she was maybe 11 or 12, she spoke English. The little boy, he spoke a little bit of English. The mother didn't speak any English. And
how long did you live there for?
9 months with them. Yeah, I lived 9 months with them. And then I moved into one house with one of these doctors who was working within the organization, you know, that was involved with the organization that my father helped create. So, and then I stayed on with her and I lived with her for almost 4 years in her house. So back to your question is how did I, about the money thing, they just live with us. I had no rent to pay.
Yeah.
I was just like, it's like winning the lottery. I don't know how I got, I mean, it's relationships. That's what everything's about. Everything, in my opinion, is it's about relationships. And I was able to live with them. And what they were getting back from the organization and the medical equipment and the education, she was just live with me. And so she's my, like, big sister. Like, we are like this. She is my sister.
The one that came to live with your parents?
Well, yes, she's my little sister. Yes, she's, but the woman at the doctor I lived with, who I eventually moved in with, and she's like my big sister.
And she's Vietnamese?
Yeah, Bac Sĩ Thủy. She was the head of the Ear, Nose, and Throat Institute in Bac Mai Hospital in Hanoi.
And at what point did you begin to learn Vietnamese?
Right away, yeah.
I mean, that was a conscious decision. I need to learn this. I'm going to stay. I'm going to learn it.
Yeah. I mean, that helps, again, from my traveling background. Yeah. It always helps to say something. You go into someone else's country, at least learn how to say thank you and please, you know, at the very minimum. That opens doors. You know, that's just basic respect.
So at what point now do you start picking a subject?
I had the subject. Oh, you mean actual subjects?
Yeah, actual subjects to say.
Can I photograph you?
Yeah, I'm going to. Well, it's more for me. I want to, because I'm very interested in the journey of an artist as well. Mm. Because, you know, you start out with this wanting and this desire to capture and express. But at some point, it becomes a way of life and a way of feeding your family and making money. But it becomes. All of this rawness that we're capturing as an artist doesn't really solidify up until some point where you're like, oh, this is sort of like where I'm honing in on. And then you develop this and then you can now sell it to galleries or get representation. And then many years later, you're shooting these churches. Yeah. So I want to get to know
the
journey to how you go from, you know, face to face.
That's 30 years.
So where along in the early days where you're like, okay, I'm gonna go here and I'm gonna start sending it back to gallery owners or whatever professionally.
After like 9 months.
Oh wow.
So my first 9 months of just shooting, and I came back with, like, you know, I shoot big cameras at that time, large format cameras. And I wasn't going around with Nikons or Canons. I come from a large format background. So the big cameras with the bellows and the, you know, you put the cover over your head. That's what I shot. Because that's the quality in those negatives is immense. And that's what I crave. So I shoot all this film. I shot Polaroid at that time because, of course, this is all film. We're talking film these days. For those who have never shot film, there was no digital. So it was all film, and I had a suitcase of Polaroid that I went through. So as I'm setting lights up, I would always shoot a Polaroid until everything was good, and I'd switch the Polaroid off and put in the film and shoot. Ziplocs, a Polaroid in with the Ziploc so I know what either the roll of film or the sheet of film, which goes into these boxes. They're big 8x10-inch sheets or 4x5-inch sheets, and they go into the freezer. And I froze my film for 9 months, and then I fly into San Francisco and go to this lab that was there, and they processed I drop all my film off, and they process my film, and I get the negatives back with contact sheets, and then I went into the darkroom, and I would make prints. And that's when I got my first maybe 20 portraits. And my first 9 months was focused on portraits. I got some landscapes too, but my focus was portraiture. So I had all these portraits. And I on my way back, I took a month, came home, 3 weeks to a month, got my fill of whatever kind of food I was missing at the time. Mexican food, maybe, probably at the most.
Everybody to go to Vietnam craves Mexican food.
And I grew up in Colorado, so, you know, it's kind of in my blood, or it was in my blood anymore. I can't eat it very much anymore. On my way back, stop in San Francisco, and I went into some galleries. And I was just, look, I'm living in Vietnam. Would you be willing to take a look at my work? Some people say yes. Some people, they don't like, you know, galleries don't tend to really like drop-ins. But I had two galleries, like, Vietnam. And so, yeah, sure. Let's see what you got. And I was 25 years old. And boom, they shot and they were like, wow, show me more when you come back. And so I developed a relationship with one particular gallery that ended up later on representing me in San Francisco. And that was my first gallery that took me on. Second one was, of course, it was in Denver, which, of course, that was an easy one to go in to see. But they were galleries that that took on black and white silver prints out of dark rooms. So, that's how it started. And then it just went on from there. But as my career went on, I worked on my first book for 4 years. And then during that time when I'm still focused on these, I went into other projects like documenting Hanoi. I had never came from Boulder, Colorado. I'd never lived in a city with, at that time, Hanoi, I think, had 4 million people in it. And so dense. And I seen the density, seeing the architecture and the urban landscape, which I was living within, I started to really look at that rather than coming from where I came from, Colorado, which is big open landscapes. And that was what my interest was, natural, out in nature. But I soon became almost obsessed with urban landscape. And so then, and those are my influences in photography are 19th century photographers. Eugène Atget, he was French, and he photographed in the late 1800s, early 1900s. He documented Paris, like windows, wrought iron, like terraces, roofs. And he has the largest collection of documentation of streets and buildings and architecture that France has, and of particularly Paris. And he was one of my influences. And so as you mature and grow as an artist, that's where I started thinking, and I started doing that with Hanoi, just with, not thinking about selling, is this going to sell? I had immediately fallen in love with this town and this city.
In the 90s, late 90s, it sounds like you were well on your way. And I'm sure you made trips back home to the U.S. Did people question what Vietnam was really like at the time? Because not a lot of people had gone, right?
Yeah.
What was sort of the sentiments of people that you would run into back in America?
The main one was like, don't those people want to kill you? No one knew anything about Vietnam. It was just, it's almost the same as today, like what we've been talking about this week. It's still, Vietnam is a war. No one knows about, like, this is a country of 4,000 years old. And we don't learn about it here in the United States. We don't learn about the history. And partly because there was an embargo, partly because that war has affected the United States more than any other war, and it still does today, as all do, but this one in particular is just still wrenching, heart-wrenching for so many people.
But you can imagine, this is going on with Kabul and Afghanistan and Iraq and everything, and the people probably there are probably, not really in that war mentality. If we go back as Americans, they're probably not even thinking they're not thinking twice about who we are.
No, like when I had gone in 93, I was, I wasn't scared, but I was a little
preconceived notions.
But immediately I found it was so shocking to me. They find out I'm American and they want me into their house for tea. Like they're so curious. And it turned out they had, which I didn't know really, but at that young age, right? They'd had two wars since the U.S. war ended, with China and Cambodia, where 1 million people died. So I remember people telling me, we don't even have time to think about that. That was 3 wars ago. We had been invaded by China, and we had the war with Cambodia in the south, And they were both over the same years, you know, 1978, 79. So that was only 4 years after the war ended with the U.S. And they're, boom, they're into a huge war with China.
I mean, these are things I don't even think about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, China, it was all through the north.
Yeah.
And then Cambodia is all the way down into the south at two different parts of the country.
At the same time.
And they're trying to be unified and they lost 1 million people.
But they got through it.
Yeah, they got through it. But because that's I would say after 30 years of my thing, the most amazing thing about the Vietnamese, they're so unbelievably resilient. And like this power of, this strength of just, it's survival. Like it's something that I can't comprehend because I didn't grow up with that. But when you are faced with, you know, wars and famine and difficulties with governments and separations of families, and like the list just goes on and on. It's just so hard to comprehend still today. You're left with nothing else to, you either survive or you die. And the fighting spirit in the Vietnamese is just, it's unbelievable. Like it's just survive, boom, and we do anything to survive after that. So, and it's something I just can't comprehend it because I've never had to experience that in life. And that's how they've gotten past this. They don't forget, but they have this incredible, this is what I've learned about, what I learned very early on. They don't forget the war with the US, but they have this incredible ability to forgive and just go forward and just go past it.
You've spent some time in the North. Have you spent some time in the South as much?
Yeah, I lived longer in Saigon. I lived eight years in Saigon.
So let me ask you a funny question.
Yeah.
Do you consider yourself more Southern or more Northern? And I ask that because I know you speak the language.
I can make enemies. I can get people pretty... what?
We'll give you a free pass because, you know... Look,
I'll say this. I am.
Don't give me any clean version.
No,
here,
this is
Peter,
not clean.
Like,
no, this is
hard.
This true from my heart.
Yeah,
I absolutely love both places. If I had to actually live there, which I will one day again, we will move back to Vietnam one day. It will. I would say the South. Mm. I would live in Saigon.
Why?
It's a weather. Now I'm going to preface everything because I won't say that I'm just solidly live there.
Yeah.
I want a house in both places.
Right. In the North and the South.
Yeah. I want a house in Hanoi. I want a house in Saigon. I want a house in Ha Long Bay. Like, I want an apartment. That's my desire. But the weather in Saigon and in the South is better. I mean, the weather is very, very, very hot and humid in the North in the summer.
But who are you? If you were to take on an animal spirit, is
Hanoi.
It the North or the South?
Yeah, I'm a Hanoian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why?
It's the vibe of the city. It's the vibe. It's the food. It's the seasons. You know, the winter. There's, I would say, three seasons. You know, it's the winter's cold. It's foggy. And you're wearing big, thick, heavy winter coats, and it's cold, and I like that. I mean, that's where I'm from, Colorado. So I like that. The leaves change, the leaves fall. Saigon is, you know, in the South, it's hot, and it's kind of the rainy season, and there's mild weather. There's definitely mild weather, which happens like right now, October through February is amazing weather.
And you're thinking, when you think in Vietnamese, do you identify more as a Hanoian or Saigon?
Probably, just because I moved there first and I lived there. My first 4.5 years in Vietnam were in Hanoi, and I love it. But I lived 8 years in Saigon, and when I'm there, I love that city. I absolutely
Saigon.
I love it. Yeah. And they're very different. They're both very different. The food's different. The people are different.
People are different. Culture's different.
Culture's different.
The way they see life is very different.
Yeah. And both of them are amazing. And then the center. You know, the center is amazing. It's much slower. But I still, actually, for me right now, the most beautiful and best city and I think vibrant and cool city right now is Da Nang. Yeah,
it's popping off the map right now.
And it's been like that for like the last 7-8 years for me. It's like, wow, this place is amazing. It's right on the, you know, it's on the beach. And that's where, you know, Aaron and I were married on the beach there, right where my dad was. It's spectacular. Yeah.
Let's get into the churches because this is something that blew my mind. Mm. So, you traveled around, and I think you began to notice this stuff on day one. The fact that there are these old churches that the French sort of brought their flavor into the north. And there's a huge Catholic contingency up in the north.
Yeah.
And we witness vestiges of French culture dotted all along the countryside in the north and around Hanoi. Tell me how you began to kind of explore these pieces and why you gravitate so much towards it.
Well, I think, you know, my first month there, I went down to the province called Ningbing, and it's south of Hanoi, about 70 to 80 kilometers. We went down there. They took me down to their house to see the relatives and so on. And I saw these enormous cathedrals, and it just blew me away. I was, what is this thing? I didn't know I didn't know these were here, you know? And they're big. These cathedrals are huge. You know, they're equal to anything in France. And, you know, you see these in
all over Europe.
All over Europe. They're huge cathedrals. You know, they fit like 1,000 to 1,500 people inside. They're enormous. And I was just completely... The interest about it was because that's the last thing I expected there. I was thinking pagodas everywhere because it's, you know, it's a Buddhist, mostly Buddhist. At least when I got there, I thought the whole country was Buddhist. I was young, so I didn't quite know the history yet. But then, of course, I found out later on, you know... These things came in before the French. The first influx of Catholicism came in 400 years ago, and then followed by the French when they came in to colonize, and then they brought much more of it in. So,
but these churches weren't there 400 years ago, right?
They weren't. There, Catholicism came in. There were smaller ones, but then eventually grew. And the main part of them were in Namding province. Namding, Ningbing, and right next to... These are three provinces that flank each other that are south of Hanoi. The center one is Namding, Ningbing, and then Taibing. And those three provinces, but particularly Namding, has the highest density of Catholicism. It's woven into the fabric. It's everyday... Like everyone in the province is Catholic. Everyone it's incredible. And there's, so I learned about all of this as time went on. But I started to take this project on again recently. You know, I was reminded of it. Actually in 2020, I read an article during COVID on, in the New York Times about, and this was resurfaced this project. I had always wanted to photograph them. I didn't know how, but I knew that that would be a project, you know, 25 years ago. I knew I'd photograph them somehow. I just didn't know how. But 2020, an article came out in the New York Times, and there's a big, huge temple in Namding that they were tearing down. And there was a lot of controversy about it. The World Bank was involved in it. And the Catholic community around the world was, you know, they wanted it. The World Bank had wanted it to become a world heritage. The government, I don't know if it was the government, but it somehow was declined and it wasn't considered a world heritage site. And it's the cathedral is called Bui Chu.
Bùi Chu. That's a very famous cathedral.
Yes. So they ended up not tearing it down, but through negotiations and money that was donated, which some was turned down according to this article, they ended up tearing some of it down and restoring a lot of it and basically just building it brand new again. And they wanted more parishioners in it. And so it's been closed. And my last trip was in June or May. I went up to it, and it's still being worked on right now. After still 2 years, you can't get into it, you can't see it, and there's huge walls around its construction and everything. So,
this episode is brought to you by Songkhai Distillery, my only go-to gin company. Established in 2018. Songkhai Distillery is Vietnam's first gin distillery, founded by Daniel Nguyen, a Vietnamese-American from Southern California. No matter how many people I have at my parties, we are always pouring Songkhai gin. Songkhai gin is handcrafted in small batches and prioritizes using botanicals and ingredients that are native and heirloom to Vietnam. The result is a product uniquely Vietnamese in taste and aroma. Songkhai is now growing to include rice wine and traditional Vietnamese herbal liqueurs similar to Amaro. Songkhai prides itself in Vietnam, from the farmers who grow the fruits and herbs to the artists behind the artwork and design. Songkhai is a community effort of people who are proud to be Vietnamese and collectively embody the spirit of Vietnam.
This is why I am fascinated by this conversation, is because I've been going back to Vietnam since the late 90s. And, you know, when you go back as just a casual visitor like me, you just see the Notre Dame in District 1. And you just think that it's something that is an anomaly, right? It's one church. And then you see all these like new-ish churches all around Saigon.
Yeah.
But when I got to see the shot that you took in your house, it's a beautiful blue patina. Mm. And you started to tell me about the history. Right. And it wasn't really you, it was Kung that was telling me about the history of this church. And then you broke it down to me at dinner time. The importance of this conversation is this. There's around, you said, 600 of these churches in Ningbing.
Namding province.
Namding province. There's 600, but they're tearing these things down.
Yeah.
And for me, the dilemma for me inside of me is, on one hand, there is a colonial aspect that I side with the government. I side with the people of Vietnam. Tear this shit down.
Yeah.
Because it's a reminder, just like the statues in the South here in America, we have reminders of Confederate generals.
Yeah. Right.
It's woven into the fabric and the history, the architectural history of Vietnam. But it pains me to see such beautiful structures being torn down. So there's like this, how do you feel about this?
Well, I it's hard for me because they're beautiful, and yes, I agree with you as well about the many struggle with the colonial past, and they don't want, that was hard for the Vietnamese, 150 years of being colonized, but it is woven into the fact, like the cities look like they do. The architecture looks like they do, largely because of the French and the Vietnamese. So there was a lot of French architecture mixed in with Vietnamese materials and Vietnamese. Everyone always thinks that it's just French colonial architecture. It's not. It's actually Vietnamese architecture also fused in with French design. So,
and you could see that too.
Yeah, and you learn that afterwards. Of course, when a general tourist goes in, it's French architecture, but it's actually not, and it's French and Vietnamese. And I'm not Vietnamese, but even though I feel it, and I've been there for so long, but it's so beautiful to me, and it's really sad to see, particularly when I live there, this untouched stuff that was just incredibly beautiful, and that's why people were going there to see this, because it was so unique. Now it either being considered very old, which it actually it is. There's a lot of wiring issues and electrical issues that need, plumbing issues. The facades, some of them are falling down. But I wish there was more of a restoration part of it that would keep it alive, and rather than just scrapping these things or completely turning them into like cafes now. Yeah. And
I could see a whole business around these church tours. You know, you have an operator that can put together, you know, 50 of these churches and the one with the most history and really guided tours. Something like that would perhaps preserve the cultural UNESCO-ish thoughts of keeping this stuff around.
And I think there are a lot of tours like that. As far as making money towards preservation, I don't know. As an artist, you know, who's dedicating and will continue to dedicate my life's work to Vietnam, this is a subject matter like at the foundation of they're coming down, and I want to document, just like I have documented so many subjects before, I want to document them before they come down to show what it was like. Like all my Hanoi work in my second book, you can go through almost every image. The city is that time period is totally gone. Like it's completely gone. There's nothing in like 40 pages, 40 images in that book. Nothing like that. You cannot see anymore.
How does that make you feel?
Well, it makes me, I guess feel good as an artist, and you know, I guess, without sounding egotistical, I'm kind of proud that I was able to look, and because I love it, I love the place, and so I wanted to
record it.
Yeah, I want to record it because it was my home, and it's a place that I felt for many years, I felt way more comfortable there than I did back in here, and that's why I continued to live there for so long. But at the same time, it's I'm sad.
Yeah, as a human being, you are doing the cultural work of preserving. This is really just humankind at this point, right? There's no white, there's no Vietnamese, there's no nothing. It's just your eyeballs and your brain is recording a relic of the infusion of these two cultures. And I think that when I think back on it, your work in the last 24 hours, because I've been thinking about this, has melted away my prejudices of holding on to the past of colonialism, of how I view white people being in Vietnam. Wow. Because now I want to approach it a little bit more openly, which is, this is just humankind preserving something just so beautiful. And when I do look back on these churches, I know that my mother came from that town. Yeah. Because she's Bac Nam Thư and Bac Ninh Nam Định and all of those places.
Yeah.
This is her hometown.
Wow.
And these are the places that I know growing up, I heard a lot of accents from Bu Chu and these places. So now I literally have context to the visual side of why these things were so popular.
Yeah.
And you're not Vietnamese. I don't look at you as a white guy anymore. I look at you as a human being because of Vietnam society and Vietnam Week and where contextually we are today, literally today. I feel just a closeness to humankind because we are able to put these pieces together of the Vietnamese culture.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know why, you know, it's interesting how to the war, this war that we are against, it out of the war creates beautiful things. I have my wife, I have three amazing children who are half Vietnamese. if the war never happened, I never would have met my wife. She wouldn't have come here. Vietnam society wouldn't exist. You know, I wouldn't have my three kids. You probably wouldn't be here.
Yeah, I think about that often.
Yeah.
And I think about Vietnam society and Vietnam Week, and I'm like, why do we need to have this?
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
What? Why is it important to have this autumn festival day inside this auditorium at Eastern Market here in D.C.? And it's not as important, I think, to somebody my generation as much as it is, it's parallel to the work that you do with the churches, is to kind of show the future generations the beauty of these things that are happening and were happening.
Yeah.
And to kind of record it because it's a beautiful thing. And I don't make any false illusions in my mind that this stuff is going to last forever. It won't. It just won't. It's just like the churches that you shoot.
Yeah.
Tat Chung Thu is not going to be third, fourth generation here.
Right.
I make no illusions about that anymore. But for the here and now, and for your children, my children, to kind of be able to witness the games and sort of like the lanterns and just vestiges of that culture is a beautiful thing.
Well, I hope that continues. I mean, you know, again, the country's 4,000 years old, so I'm not quite sure exactly how long Tet Chung Thu has been going on, but I know it's an extremely long time, maybe 2,000 years old. I don't know exactly.
But I wonder how long, you know, my kids, your kids, their kids are going to care about this stuff, you know? Because you look at fourth generation, fifth generation Japanese, you know, it's... they're just now... And I used to have so much judgment about that. But now I'm beginning... Because of this experience with the churches, I'm beginning to see it differently. It's like, hey, this is here for me to enjoy now. You know, what you put up is something I can connect with because I know the history of my mother and her connection to Catholicism and that part of the world. And when she sees these pictures in a book or something, it will rock her soul because she's a diehard Catholic. And and no judgment anymore because, you know, I really walked away from Catholicism. But but now it brings on a whole new meaning, the churches and the beauty of it.
You know, it's interesting you say that because they're the people who I meet actually, you know, particularly, in Vietnam and in particular in Hanoi, because that's when I go into work there in Nam Dinh, I'll do like 9 days in Nam Dinh, and then I come back to Hanoi for 2 days because the work is very intense. And then I go back down there for like another 9-10 straight days of working. You know, it's getting up at 4:30 a.m., 4 a.m. And, you know, we're working until the sun goes down. Eat dinner, go back to your little, you know, hotel. And then, you know, I got to download images, blah, blah, blah. Get some sleep. And then I'm back up again at 4 a.m. It's just driving around. So the people, when I come back in to Hanoi, when I come back and talk, people are actually, and even my assistants who are with me, they know what I'm doing. And they've been working with me for a long time, but then they start learning about all of this. And when talking to other people, adults, you know, even adults in Hanoi, and I show them the images and they're like, oh my God, I know these are there, but I've never really taken the time to really understand how incredible these places are. And other, particularly young people, like, you know, 20s to 40, when I show them, they are like, some of them are even like, this is Vietnam. Some of them don't even know.
I wish there was a podcast just dedicated to the history, the design, the paints, the patinas, the architecture, everything of these churches. And then one that we just dedicate to, and we'll get into this right now, to the shooting of the church. Just
make one.
No, I mean, it requires a lot of bandwidth, to really put something like, you know, like a 10-part series on these churches. But it's so esoteric, it's so niche that, I'm totally fascinated because each facade has a different feel.
Yeah.
And like, who designed this stuff? Who are the builders? Yeah. How did they finance this stuff? How did they fund it?
Yeah. Actually, that's a great question. I don't know about the funding of all of that. I know that I do know that there's Baroque architecture, and there's a large amount of Baroque architecture mixed in with Vietnamese architecture, and then some, like the prints, the large print that I showed you, that's, you know, behind us here, that is mixed in with the actual a temple, a pagoda, and mixed in, and it's a Catholic cathedral, you know, but it takes, and it's got the meshing of like a Buddhist pagoda mixed in with Catholic cathedral
elements
on it, and it's it's amazing. And so the French, they were designed in, but all the Vietnamese built it. And that's where I want the Vietnamese to be proud of that. Like, it wasn't like a crew of the French were in building these. Like, Vietnamese hands built that. Vietnamese blood, Vietnamese hands built all of that.
But if you think about it, there's 600 of these still around. Maybe there was 1,000 at a time.
I think that's just kind of an average number of they're everywhere. Like, you're on top of one, and you make a 360.
Another, yeah.
You see at least within like 2 kilometers, you know, whatever, like a mile away, you can see in the distance, you can count like probably
the 5 or 6 of another one. Yeah.
They're everywhere. Yeah. Everywhere. Yeah.
And like, again, you know, my brain goes to how did they, I mean, these are probably equivalent to multi-million dollar projects back in the day.
Yeah.
And who funded it? Who put all this stuff together?
I have no idea.
Because they just didn't magically appear like a mushroom.
And it's a lot of material. And there's stained glass in it. It's not like painted glass. These are stained glass. You know, it's stained glass that's in there. And, there's the tiles on the roof, like the one that I showed you. I mean, that looks like it's right out of Italy.
Yeah.
You know, and all the tiles on the top, and that's expensive material. And to get them cut, and then all the motifs all the way around, and the when you get up, when people go in and see these, like, you know, the carving into them, into the stones and the bricks.
Intricate work.
It's incredible.
When you first started to see these things, I'm sure that you were wondering, because we talked about this, I'm sure you were wondering, because when you're standing below on the floor level, did you think that you were getting an accurate picture in your mind's eye of the facade? I mean, what was your approach to getting this thing shot?
Yeah, well, I'm an architectural photographer, so you know, you'd asked me earlier about my career. It was starting about 15, 18 years ago, I started to transition into urban architecture, and then solidly architecture, man-made structure. So I like things very uniform, very structured, very, I don't like, as an architectural photographer, I don't like converging lines going up, like looking up at a building. I like things very straightforward, very...
So when your perspective skews the lines, right?
Yes. And so these things are so big that normally I would want to get up on, you know, if there was a building, you know, in front of it, I'd get up on like the 10th floor and shoot straight out to see how the architect originally thought, you know, when they think of these cathedrals, how they thought them to be designed. They didn't think of them being down on the ground looking up at them and seeing lines go up. And they always, when they're drawing them, they have an idea. And but there are no 10-story buildings outside of these things. So it took me a very long time to think about how to get perspective on this. And that's when I told you I found a company in Europe that has these tripods. They're actually made for satellite phones, or you see them on satellite dishes. You see them on television crews where they, on the back of a truck, there'll be like this pneumatic mast that goes up like 30, 40, 50 feet. The military uses them all the time. And there are these sections of, you know, 1 meter that you pump them up.
Hydraulic
goes up. Mine is pneumatic, so you pump it up with a hand pump. And they just, these sections go up, and their mine goes up 32 feet or 8 meters. And I found a mount for the top of mount the camera on that has a long cable, and then you, the, I can do a little bit of movement. The camera can go up
so
and down.
So the base can tilt, swivel. Yeah.
And pan and so on. And then the my camera has cords that go in, and it comes down to my laptop. And we, I just, now I can put that thing anywhere I want, and I'm 32 feet up in the air, and I get the perfect perspective to when you have a 90-foot or 100-foot cathedral going up. I am pretty much in the middle going up, and I have this perspective that no one can ever get, mm-hmm. and it shows these things in the light that I feel that they should be shown in.
And is there a feed that you get to your laptop?
Yeah,
that you
can so it's see? A live feed. Live so feed. Yeah, so it's going down. And so I can see live on there, and I, you know, and I then I, you know, pan the head to where I need it to go, and then get finally get it, and then I can just push on the computer, and I can fire the camera shutter.
How much permission do you need from the government or people
Zero.
Around?
Zero.
Zero. They don't care?
No. No.
I mean, somebody should be paying you, running up to you and say, thank you so much. Here's a red envelope, you know, for doing this.
I wish. Hopefully, you know, I hope one day, I really do hope. I hope this means something to the Vietnamese. I hope all the work that I've been doing over the 30 years, I hope my documentation of Hanoi will mean something to, you know, the Ministry of Culture and the cultural historians, you know, that I hope my recording of Vietnam and the landscapes and so on will actually serve as a record, you know, for the government and for the people. Like that, and that it will be able to be shared, and you know, long after I'm gone. That's part of what I want my legacy to be about, that I documented this country and I photographed things that are no longer here. This is what we used to be.
And why do you think you give so much emotions to this specific region or work?
I don't know. I really don't know. It's just my calling. I guess if you want to get down to it, I have faith in God. That is who I am. I'm not Catholic. I'm Christian, but my faith, and it, I grew up with faith as a young kid. I left it. I never not believed in God, but I just didn't follow God. I didn't think about God, and I always prayed to God when I was in trouble or something, you know, or as it, but around 15, I stopped going to church and just kind of living off. And then it was in, you know, my mid-40s, started coming back to my faith. And so personally, it's something that I believe in, that this is my calling. And this is part of my work, is to give, to help heal, to create understanding, for people who don't know about Vietnam, Americans, Europeans, whoever, and Vietnamese themselves, and also to people in Vietnam who have never traveled. It's something that I hope that can create awareness and understanding for their own country. And it's just something I believe that it was from the war. For my instance, it was for the war, because my father went there, and that's where the interest came in for me. And as soon as I, like I said, as soon as I landed, it was like, this is where I'm supposed to be. And then, you know, I have a Vietnamese wife. I've half, you know, my kids are Vietnamese. And quite honestly, I am as comfortable there. Actually, I'm probably more comfortable.
I was gonna say that.
I am probably more comfortable there than I am here. And it's been that way actually for probably a good 15 to 18 years, even though I struggle there sometimes, because there's certain things about here that I don't like,
yeah.
and I struggle with as well. But I'm so comfortable there in all situations, whether I'm in the countryside, whether I'm in deep into the Mekong Delta, whether I'm in both any city. I'm just like, I'm out on my own. I absolutely love it.
You know, we all have these funny assumptions in life where you look at something and you assume what you think and what you see is, you know, I'd been working with Erin for the last few months, you know, kind of supporting her and making introductions when I can. And I'm like, I see your name and I don't know who you are and it's off to the sidelines. I'm like, oh, Peter's just here for the ride, right? But that's not the case at all. Mm. It's not. Now I could see the driving force of two people doing this enormous heavy lifting here in Washington, D.C. To put these events. And I would like my audience to know how important it is to travel to Washington, D.C. every Tachungtu from here on out. And I really continue. I hope that you both continue to do the work that you do, because although I come from the biggest community outside of Vietnam, the biggest Vietnamese community outside of Vietnam in Orange County and LA, this is nothing. We have not put on anything compared to what you guys have done here in Washington, D.C. Mm.
Thank you. It's like what we've spoken about in certain situations. We started thinking about this 20 years ago, and that's, I think, that was most certainly, you know, an odd situation how Erin and I met in the very first place, because she saw one of my images at an exhibition and it brought her back to her childhood. Even though she was American, she was going back to Vietnam every 6 weeks. She wasn't feeling Vietnamese then, because she coming here in 79 and having to, like what I spoke about before, survive. And that meant be an American. That's in her words. She had to become American to she was living here and she wanted to succeed. So her image of me seeing my image made her feel Vietnamese again. And when we met, I think through my work, trying to think about like who this white guy is, you know, who's been living there already, who's been working there for 20 years already, knows so much more about my country than I do. And those are her words. And eventually this started bringing her back. And then we started thinking about all of these things. 20 years ago, we saw a film festival at the Smithsonian here. And that's when we both came out and we were like, one day we got to have a Vietnamese film festival here. You know, let's do a Vietnamese, because there was no Vietnamese films here. And so here we are 20 years later, and not only did we have a film festival, but we have a whole entire week, Vietnam week, planned with, you know, writers and authors and artists and culinary, and throughout the rest of the year, too. We have events every month and a half. We have something going on, too. So and that's promoting, again, that's promoting Vietnam through art and culture. There's no politics, there's nothing. It's just solidly art and culture to bring awareness and to Vietnam.
Peter, you're a storyteller by trade, by definition, your heart. What is the difference between the storytelling that you do through photography with these churches versus the, I guess what I'm asking is, why not put a documentary together to explain more? Because now I'm like, I'm banging at the door for you to be like, can you find out more? You're over there. Yeah. Why don't you just put a video crew together? I'm just wondering aloud, has that crossed your mind? Why would you not do that? Because your visual ability to put these frames together continuously to put some context to the history, to the way these things are built, the design, the funding. I'm sure you have the same questions I do.
Yeah.
Why? What would stop you from doing that? And what's the difference? I mean, has it ever thought across your mind?
I guess me personally doing that, it's more of mental capacity. What I can, you know, it takes so much of my time and my focus to actually just work on my project alone. However, it's interesting you say there is There is a Vietnamese company who actually went with me. They are making a documentary on me, and particularly on this project. And sweet. They went with me for 3 days on my last trip down to Nam Dinh, and they will be going again. VTV, you know, Vietnam Television 4, who just interviewed us and who was here, who you met, they are going to do a story on this as well, which I you know, yeah, it's a feather in my cap or whatever. I'm happy. I don't particularly like seeing myself on TV and stuff. I don't like hearing myself. I'm very critical of myself on that. But I hope it brings awareness again, more awareness to, on this particular subject of the cathedrals. You know, they're, these things are 150, 135 years old, and they're being torn down. And it's sad, and they need to be
they need to be protected.
They need to be protected, and
there needs to be. It sounds like VTV is going in to do 3 days, 4 days with a profile on you, but you, yeah. I'm sorry, need to be the leader of this, like, yeah, a bigger documentary, because I would enjoy it from your visualization of these churches in a video or in film, right?
I need a crew to help me, like a planner and
that's
and
what producer, I'm talking about. Yeah, yeah, because I mean, this sounds like VTV's segment, you know, it's a segment, but if you were to be like getting down to the history and really digging deep and getting visual, like the way, you know, you do in photography.
Yeah.
That would be a different level.
I'm hoping that will happen with this other company who is actually, they are funding it and they are doing the full document. Like, they are making a documentary and they are going to follow me the entire project. We are searching out historians, actually. I'm not a historian.
I can help with that. You know? I can help some historians, yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. I mean, you know, getting a historian to look into the history of all of these and what's happening behind the planning. I don't know the future of the plan. I just know that they're coming down, and I know I'm scratching the surface on all of this stuff. My job is just to photograph and document them before they come down in an artistic way as well. I'm an artist, and these are my main source of income is selling prints and galleries. And so I'm actually photographing these in a contemporary photographic vision that I'm hoping that people would want a beautiful contemporary print that's, you know, it's 80 inches tall by 64 inches wide.
It's like a vertical big screen TV on a wall inside of your living room or something. They're beautiful. Yeah. The blue church that you have in your, it's like magnificent. And who in their right mind as a Vietnamese person would not want to own one of those, you know?
Well, that's what I hope. I've got three kids going into college. I need some print sales. No, it's but that is actually how I make my make my living as a professional artist. But I, back to your point about the documentary, I would love to have, you know, I think it's important too. I mean, of course, I would love to have a documentary on, because I do feel the importance of it. That's a big project, and there needs to be funding for it as well. But it's again, like, the basis of this, it's important. Like, this is important for the history of this country. Other photographers are doing other things, and other photographers are, you know, here in the U.S., they're documenting and making documents on this or that. Or my calling, for some reason, ended up in Vietnam. And sometimes it takes an outsider to see what you live within. Like, I have a project in Hong Kong called Surface Unseen. I lived in Hong Kong for 6 years, and I love it there. And I see things, I go around, see things, because it was a new place for me. And I could see things that normal everyday people go by and they don't catch. And it's the same thing with here, you know, when we had so many friends from Vietnam who were here this week, they were just on driving into DC. They were pointing things out that I drive by every day that I didn't see. And so sometimes it takes an outsider to come in to see things differently and point things out. And maybe that's where my calling came in. And all I know is that every time I go there, I mean, I have a list of projects that is, it's like 20 deep. I mean, it'll continue the rest of my lifetime. I know that I will just continue to photograph there. I have like 20 projects I could work on right now.
The church project for me hits me in a,
wow.
It's
well, your grandmother's the, from,
yeah,
from,
that's why. Yeah. Yeah. And it's probably the way Aaron, now I get it. Now I see the connection that Aaron saw in you, 20 years ago or however many years ago when yeah. she felt that connection. Cause when I saw the church, and you know, I just, it's just a strange connection. Like I have scenarios playing in my mind right now. Like how could I be involved in this documentary? This is how deep it's going.
Wow.
How connected I feel about it right now. So thank you so much, Peter, for coming on, and actually opening up your studio, your home, your city to your guests and to me, and allowing me to sit and have this conversation with the work that you do.
This week has been great. It's been fabulous meeting you, you know, and as soon as I've known about your podcast, and it's just, I'm listening to it all the time, and it's just like, wow, this is awesome, you know, and then when you get in involved with Aaron to ask her to come on, and we're talking with you to come in here to Vietnam Week. I was just really excited to meet you, and this has been a privilege, and I'm so happy you asked me to be on this. I'm not Vietnamese, but I'm sitting here and giving the last 30 years of my life, you know, work in that country here. That's what I'm dedicated to.
Yeah, and I appreciate and now that. I've opened my heart a little bit more to the fact that just because the guest is not Vietnamese, because I still have reservations, but after today, I'm like, wait a minute, I have to get a little bit more, a lot more open with this idea of anyone who is contributing to the cultural sort of like visualization or taste or whatever it's a building block, and it's a mosaic of things that human beings can experience when it comes to Vietnam. So I appreciate you opening up my mind and my heart and being able to experience Vietnam through a completely different lens.
Right. Oh, this was fabulous. Thanks for
thank
having
you, Peter.
Thanks for having me on. Yeah. Excellent.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.